From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mike McCabe talks about new priorities and funding public schools in Wisconsin.
We can have it so that schools aren't so heavily reliant on the property tax if we have an overall tax system that is fair for everybody and that does expect everybody to pull their weight.
Later, how a Milwaukee college is setting out to measure whether its graduates are truly ready for the work world.
Plus, it's not a dining faux pas to bring nutritious food to your holiday potluck or get together.
You will not be looked down upon for bringing something a little healthier than some of the other things. Someone else can bring the little fried egg rolls and the pigs in a blanket.
And an in-studio performance from the duo of Sarah and Kenny. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The primary elections for Wisconsin governor are 236 days away. And while Governor Walker is a sure bet to capture the Republican nomination ahead of his try for a third term, the Democratic field is wide open, with more than a dozen candidates already announced.
Between now and the primaries and general election, we're going to speak with as many candidates for governor as we can. We start today with Mike McCabe, the founder of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, is running a grassroots campaign which found its way to Milwaukee yesterday, and McCabe joined us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Your campaign slogan is principle over party, but you are running, obviously, for the Democratic nomination for governor in a crowded field. If my count is correct, I believe there are 18 people who have filed to run for governor as Democrats. How do you distinguish yourself among them?
Yeah, this might end up being the Baskin-Robbins primary with 31 flavors. We'll see. But, I think they're all very accomplished people. It's a good group of people seeking the nomination. But I notice some things that they have in common that I don't share with them. And one of those things is that they all seem pretty comfortable operating within the political system as it currently functions. They seem at peace with the political culture as it is, and I'm not. I think our political culture in Wisconsin has been poisoned. I think the system is working really, really well for a wealthy and well-connected and privileged few, but it's failing the rest of the population, and it needs to be shaken up and transformed. And that's what motivates me to be in this race. This is about getting regular people a voice and getting them in the driver's seat of our government. And and your average voter out there really feels that they're not being represented, that they're not being listened to, their voices are not being heard. That's got to change.
So how do you change the system while still having to participate in the system to be in a position to change the system?
Well, I've done work for decades, of course, when I ran the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, working from the outside in and trying to expose and break the grip of the influence of big money in politics and work for other reforms that would make our democracy healthier. I'm proud of that work, but I think there also comes a time when people have to be willing to run for office and seek to hold elected office to change the tone and the behavior of those in government. And to me, a big part of this is those who govern should be servants and not masters. And that, to me, puts them under the people, not above them. And when you look at the capital culture today, I think that's what drives so many people crazy, is they feel like politicians are feathering their own nests, they're climbing the ladder, they're stepping over whoever they need to get where they want to go. They're looking out for their own careers. They're scratching the backs of those who scratch theirs. That drives people crazy because they don't feel like they're actually working for the people. Well, to change that, we've got to have people willing to run for and hold office who are willing to say, look, I'm a servant, not a master. That puts me under the people, not above them. And it means that I have to change the way the people's business is done in the Capitol. You have to do everything in your power to make that change. It starts with leadership by example. And that's a big reason why I'm in this race.
There, I think, are a lot of people who are probably cynical at this point. They may have sent people to office on promises that yep. they would, you know, to use the president's terminology, drain the swamp.
Yep.
But there are plenty of candidates on both ends of the spectrum who are elected saying they're going to change things. And people see that nothing changes when they get to office. If you're elected governor, you're still only one person.
Mm-hmm.
How do you bring in? You talk about leading by example, but practically, how does that work?
Well, but we keep in mind that Wisconsin is a strong governor state. You take a state like Texas, governors can't do much more than issue symbolic proclamations. In Wisconsin, we've got a very strong governor institution. In large part because of the partial veto authority, because of the ability to substantially rewrite any legislation that spends money. So a governor in Wisconsin can, in fact, do a lot to change the way government works. Not only does the governor get to appoint the leaders of all the state agencies and change the tone and the behavior in state government that way, but that partial veto authority is immense. So again, it starts with leadership by example. If I'm elected governor, I'm not going to live in the governor's mansion. If I'm elected governor, I'm not going to take the full salary of the governor. I'm going to be paid $1 less than the average Wisconsin worker makes. To me, those are commitments. Those are things that I can follow through without legislative approval. I lead by example in that way. But even before getting elected, I've got to lead by example. So I can't in good conscience take the $20,000 donations from individuals that candidates for governor are legally allowed to take. I can't take $86,000 from a political action committee that you can legally take as a candidate for governor, because everything I've experienced in all my years has shown me that there are strings attached to those donations, that they come with expectations, that they are in effect legal bribes. So my campaign will be fueled by donation, no single donation over $200. And that's that makes a statement to people that this campaign is going to have to be people-powered. It's going to have to be crowdfunded. It's going to have to be truly grassroots in nature. This campaign is going to have to be run in a way that reflects the sort of change that we need in our government. We've got to lead by example, and it starts while you campaign, and then it continues once you're elected to office.
Let's talk about some of the specific issues that are probably on people's minds. The governor and other Republicans say they're making property tax relief a big priority. What's your take on the state of property taxes in this state and their use versus their burden?
I think that we've got a situation now where, because property taxes are the main source of revenue for schools, for example, we've got schools on a starvation diet. We've got rural schools that are teetering on the brink of extinction. They're at a point where they can't even be viable. So we've got to be willing to broaden our approach to taxation in Wisconsin. We particularly have to have a system of taxation in Wisconsin that expects everybody in every income class to pull their weight and pay their fair share. Right now in Wisconsin, if you combine all the state and local taxes we pay, the wealthiest 1% of taxpayers pays the lowest overall tax rate. They pay the lowest percentage of their incomes in taxes. That's got to change. We've got to say that we've got to have a tax system where everybody pays their fair share. We don't need any new taxes, but we sure as heck have to make sure that everyone pays the ones we've already got. And we can have it so that schools aren't so heavily reliant on the property tax if we have an overall tax system that is fair for everybody and that does expect everybody to pull their weight.
So you would seek to reconfigure the tax code.
Absolutely. We've got to have a system. You know, again, we don't need any new taxes, but we've got to make sure that everybody pays the ones that we've already got. There are way too many people who are able to escape taxation. And again, the wealthiest 1% of taxpayers pays the lowest overall tax rate, and that's wrong.
We're talking in Milwaukee, of course, and just to the south of us is a major factory project that is scheduled to soon get underway. How do you weigh the merits and the risks of the Foxconn deal?
Corporate welfare is just not the way to build a sturdy economy. For decades, Wisconsin has taken this approach of trying to feed the rich, shower tax breaks and state subsidies on a few thousand people or a few huge corporations or one global conglomerate from Taiwan, with the hopes that some of what they're given will filter down to the rest of the population. And it has failed us. We're leading the nation in shrinkage of the middle class. We're dead last in the nation in new business startups for 3 straight years. We've got levels of economic inequality not seen in Wisconsin since the Great Depression. So I think we've got to do a complete about face in the way we approach building a sturdy economy. Instead of trying to build one from the top down, we've got to build one from the bottom up that empowers 5.5 million people to do more for themselves and for their families and for each other and for our state. And that means creating an economy where if you work, you won't be poor, a living wage for every worker, affordable health insurance for all, debt-free education for everyone. Bring high-speed internet to every community, high-speed internet everywhere. That's got to be a commitment. And we've got to really commit to building a clean energy economy. It should be Wisconsin's goal to be the first state in the nation fully powered by renewable energy. If we make those investments, we empower 5.5 million people to do more for themselves and for each other. We put more money in the pockets of regular people. They spend it. That'll stimulate the economy. Low wages is a killer for our economy. It suppresses demand. It inhibits sales. It ends up damaging our economy. We have to put more money in the pockets of regular working people. That will stimulate the economy, and that's the way to build a sturdy economy is from the bottom up.
To return briefly to Foxconn, so would you have pursued the deal or pursued it differently or just sought it at all?
It's the wrong approach. Corporate welfare is a losing game, and if we continue down this road, there are going to be more Foxconns down the road, and we won't see significant job growth. I've gone so far as to say that the state's corporate welfare office, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, should be abolished. We should do away with it and take hundreds of millions of dollars from that use that has put us in a position where we're leading where we're dead last in the nation in new business startups and leading the nation in shrinkage of the middle class. We've got to plow that money into things like health care for all, affordable, debt-free education, bringing high-speed internet to places that don't have it, empowering people to be able to take their ideas and start new businesses, putting money into the pockets of working people. That's the way you create a vibrant and sturdy economy.
Well, and so in terms of paying for your agenda, these are two things that you've talked about here, two key things. And I just want to make sure I have it right. You're talking about changes to the tax code and potentially reappropriating funds away from things like corporate development.
Yeah, we've got to have a tax system that is fair for everybody in every income class. We don't have that currently in Wisconsin. And then we should have a basic rule in government where if a program works, you keep it and you fund it. If a program doesn't work, you get rid of it. And by that standard, the corporate welfare office should be done away with because its whole purpose is to promote and create new business startups. And we're dead last for three straight years in new business startups. So the agency has failed in its mission. It's been a train wreck of an agency, can't keep track of its own funds, has no way of tracking if any jobs are created. And so we should do away with that failed program and put that money to a better use, repurpose that funding for a much more constructive use.
As you look around the country, are there other states you see that you think are doing it right?
Well, take a look at right across the border. Wisconsin and Minnesota have always had so much in common. We've been twins. We have common landscapes, common populations, common political traditions. We've had so much in common, yet the two states have taken two very radically different paths in very recent years when it comes to the economy. Minnesota raised taxes on the rich, boosted education spending, and raised wages, substantially increasing their minimum wage. Wisconsin, on the other hand, went the exact opposite direction. We cut taxes on the rich, cut education spending, and kept wages as low as federal law allows. And Minnesota is outperforming Wisconsin by every economic measure. They have distanced themselves from Wisconsin when it comes to economic development and growth. So Wisconsin took one path. Minnesota took a very different path. And Minnesota is way out ahead. We have a state budget that spends more on prisons than on our whole university system. Minnesota spends vastly less on prisons because they deal with nonviolent offenders very differently. They don't incarcerate them. And so they are able to invest way more in success, and we're paying more and more for failure. So, yes, there's a state right across the border that has taken a very different approach, and it has proven to be a superior approach because they're outpacing Wisconsin by any economic measure you choose to look at.
Your website notes that your candidacy emerged from a letter from some 200 or so people around the state. At what point did you leave your reluctance to run for office behind?
You know, I remember speaking in La Crosse and having people come up to me afterwards, you know, and asking me to run for office. And that was back in January or February. And my answer was no or hell no. And they didn't take no for an answer. That's the curious thing. And pretty soon there was this letter being circulated and a draft movement and then an online petition on change.org. And And people kept pushing, and I was speaking at various places around the state, and people just wouldn't take no for an answer. And what it made me realize is that there are an awful lot of people who are terribly hungry for a new kind of leadership and a new politics. And they expect people who maybe haven't pursued this path all their lives to think about stepping outside their comfort zone and doing some things that maybe they hadn't planned to do. And what I basically said is, if you're willing to make this journey with me, I'm willing to make the journey. And what I've found is an awful lot of people who are open to pushing outside their comfort zones, and they're doing some really inspiring things, creating grassroots volunteer networks. They're engaging in politics in ways that they haven't before. That speaks to the hunger that they have for a different kind of leadership. And so I'm like them. I finally had to come to terms with the thought that maybe I would have to do something that I hadn't planned on doing my whole life. And here I am.
Well, Mike McCabe, thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, Mitch. Good talking with you.
Mike McCabe is running for the Democratic nomination in next year's gubernatorial race. McCabe is the founder of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and he's the author of the book Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. We'll hear from other gubernatorial candidates in the weeks and months to come.
Next on the show, how a Milwaukee college is setting out to measure whether its graduates are truly ready for the work world. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Whether the jobs are white-collar or blue-collar, whether the company is Foxconn or a much smaller employer, questions are always raised about whether people graduating from schools are ready for employment. Sometimes the question involves specialized skills, but increasingly the questions are bigger and seemingly simpler. Are students prepared to join the workforce?
It is a field known as essential employable qualities, and a Milwaukee college will soon play a role in figuring out how they're measured. Carol Shabrias is Dean of the School of Adult Learning and New Initiatives at Alverno College, and she joins us in the studio to explain. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start with a working definition, if we can. What are we talking about when we talk about essential employable qualities?
We're really talking about a set of abilities that people have when they enter the world and engage with other people. So it's different from something like the ability to type or the ability to code. It's more about the ability to work in a space where there are other people who with you are thinking and leading and problem solving and disagreeing and challenging, and how you comport yourself in an environment like that.
But this goes over and above what we might think of simply as people skills, right? Or is this really what we're talking about?
You know, it's a good question. I feel like there's a way that this is getting at the heart of what it means to be human. Can you move in the world in a way that helps other people go with you and accomplish things with you? But when people talk about people skills and soft skills in terms of graduates from college, I think they're kind of missing depth. They're kind of thinking, you know, can you work on a team? Well, what the hell does that mean? Oh, I'm sorry, I just swore on radio.
That's all right.
All right. Yeah, so it's more than people skills. And Alverno's model is actually fundamentally about your personal understanding of yourself. And that's a version of people skill, but that has to do with self-awareness.
In some ways, it seems like a lot to add. I mean, and I realize there are a lot of older graduates at Alverno who might have a head start at knowing themselves versus, you know, a 21 or 22-year-old who's coming out of college. But at some level, it seems like a lot to expect of a college graduate to be this complete formed person the second they walk out your door.
So we help them in sequential ways while they're with us. So this is not about the EEQ project, but Alverno's educational model requires students to practice and demonstrate competencies along the way, to get feedback from their faculty, and to assess themselves on the same things that the faculty were assessing. And then the next time they're tested, as it were, they have to demonstrate self-awareness and growth. And so they may not be fully formed at 21 or 25 when they graduate, but they are practiced at growing and practiced at identifying the ways they need to continue their growth.
Well, and you said that's not specifically about the EEQs, but it's really related to it in a lot. I mean, it seems like that's why this is such a – being part of this pilot project is such a good match for Alverno, right?
Oh, absolutely. I should say more, but I don't know what
that's
to say,
all right. So. But okay. So let me ask then, and maybe you don't know the answer to this yet. How do you measure these kinds of things? I mean, this is not the same as can this person code at this level. This
right.
is not the same as has this person finished trigonometry or has this person been able to analyze existentialism. How do you tell whether a person leaving has the kinds of qualities that are going to be needed, maybe next week or maybe 5 years from now?
So let me talk about two pieces of that. One is about how you verify that a graduate has those skills, but the other is what it means to have a program that is also verified as producing those graduates. So Alverno is really practiced at producing those graduates. We have this sort of complicated matrix where we lay out the different competencies students have to achieve and give them multiple efforts at demonstrating that competency. And that's embedded throughout our curriculum. So we're really practiced at that piece. And it's one of the reasons that the QA Commons called us for the EEQ, because like other competency-based colleges, we're good at this. The EEQ piece is in development. So part of your question I can't answer yet.
Right.
So what they've said is we want a whole bunch of colleges who are good at this to help us build it so that they are informed by faculty members and administrators who are already engaged in best practices, because what they want at the end of the day is not something that works at Alverno or works somewhere else, but that works across a system so that there can be a national conversation about it and not only local conversations.
So you talk about the matrix and you talk about competencies. Can you give us a sense for what that looks like and feels like if you are a student at Alverno?
Sure. I'm looking right now at our outcomes for our business major. We have four competencies that all graduating students have to meet. One is in critical thinking, one is in leadership, one is in decision making, and then one is in something we call entrepreneurial careering, which is about a student's flexibility and adaptability as she plans her profession and engages in professional growth. So we can tell you, we've got this matrix that describes what each one of those are, maps it back to our abilities, and then has a whole set of learning activities that the faculty can use from and draw to both kind of build into their classrooms, but also to evaluate the students against. So the student can come in and see, these are the abilities, these are the outcomes, these are the kinds of ways I'm going to get validated, and I'll have a chance to practice and grow.
This has not always been the domain of higher education. I mean, and probably to this day, there are still colleges and universities out there who say, look, it's our job to give them the book learning.
Yep.
And, whether they got the employability piece is not necessarily just on them, but, it's not our responsibility to make sure that student X is going to be the right worker for company Y.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess – why has Alverno seen it differently through the years?
So, again, with the two-answer thing, we moved to this abilities model 40 years ago at a moment when we had a very progressive president who had a vision about what it would mean to put women in the workplace in a way that made them distinct. And that was kind of the heart and soul of our model. I think I would be in trouble with our faculty if I didn't also say the book learning matters, right? The content really matters. And so we really embed both throughout every program. More and more, I mean, you know this, you hear this all the time, liberal arts doesn't matter, a college degree isn't worth it. Showing that, can I give an example?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
So I'm an English major. And so I learned—
An English major with a job.
An English
major,
right, right. I actually have 3 degrees in English and I still have a job. So I learned – I know, shocking, right?
You would think with each successive degree, you might be less employable.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. I know. So you learn when you study English a whole bunch of ways to analyze a whole bunch of texts. Well, there aren't that many jobs in the world where my ability to analyze poetry is going to get me hired. But what I learned as an English major was how to learn a framework and apply that framework in solving a problem. So I still learned all the literature. I learned novels and poetry and the whole range. But on the market, my job is to say, sure, I have that content piece, but I also have this ability to solve problems, to learn different ways of looking at the world, and that sort of thing.
Do you think you had professors who got that part, you know, who opened your eyes to that part of the equation?
No, and I would say
So you had to figure it out for yourself.
I'm old enough that I had to figure it out for myself, and I think this way now because of the kind of work I do. But increasingly, even at small liberal arts colleges, faculty are really focused on helping students understand how what they learn in their major is multifaceted. It's partly content and it's partly capability.
Well, and it seems like it takes a certain kind of faculty member to get both parts of the equation.
It really does. And it also takes an institution that has fundamentally its students' best interests at heart. And Alverno is distinct in a little bit in that I'll get in trouble with other schools if I say they're not. But we care so much about the region and we care so much about especially putting women to work in ways that stabilize their socioeconomic standing, that give them rewarding careers, that help their families. And you can't do all that if all you teach them is content. You have to teach them how to succeed with that material.
So, and again, maybe this is too early to say, but do you know how the pilot project is going to start playing out at Alverno yet?
I don't. The pilot project is in two phases. We're in the first phase, which is convening the partners to figure out exactly how to name the EEQs. We've got draft names of them, and some of us have feelings about the language, as you'd imagine a bunch of higher ed people would.
Especially ones who might be English majors.
Right, right. And there are other universities that have a competency-based model, and so we all feel very strongly that we are really good at this, and so we want to help shape it. So we're spending this year refining both the qualities themselves and developing a process by which programs become validated or I forget what the word they actually use is, but certified as an EEQ program. Once we've created that framework, then year two, which starts next fall, is having programs go through that framework to see if the framework actually works before we try and roll it out further. One of the things we've learned at Alverno is that the draft EEQs and our aid abilities are a real nice alignment. You can draw clear connecting lines among them. So I think the ways that it'll play out at Alverno is that we'll be able to continue doing what we already do. We'll have another platform for making it public, and we'll have another thing that a graduate can walk out in the world and say, hey, I've got this thing too that will make me a better candidate for the work I'm looking for.
Well, and it sounds like we have more interviews to do as this starts.
That would be great.
To coalesce.
Yeah.
Well, Carol Shabrias, thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thanks so much.
Carol Shabrias is Dean of the School of Adult Learning and New Initiatives at Alverno College. Alverno is one of two schools in Wisconsin and 14 around the country to help develop ways to assess students' so-called essential employable qualities.
You can learn more and hear Rachel Morello's story on a high school teaching these qualities at WUWN.com.
We'll take another break now and then have some strategies for conjuring and harnessing your coping skills during the sometimes stressful holiday season. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This time of year can mean the delights of decorations, merriment, family, and feasts, but the holidays often bring more stress into our lives as well. Whether it's additional expectations we place on ourselves, a busier overall schedule, or the complex relationships between friends or relatives, this time of year can certainly throw a wrench in healthy habits.
But Lake Effect contributor and Wisconsin Athletic Club nutrition director Kim Flannery says it's important to remember that we're all human, and this time of year can affect each of us in different ways. She joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to talk about unique holiday stressors and to offer some helpful tips on how we can understand and harness the willpower to combat holiday stress.
With eating, when we're stressed out, we kind of lose our willpower. We kind of tap into a lot of that emotional part of ourselves that tends to take the brain offline, so to speak, and leads us down those habit paths that we've practiced, some of those habits that we may not want to continue, but we nonetheless continue to practice them, and they lay down those tracks pretty solid.
Right. With so much happening during the holidays, perhaps we've made efforts to alter our bad habits and trying it into better ones before the holiday comes. Mm-hmm. But often people see this as like even a 2-month free period, you know,
right.
Derailment. So how do you think we can stay on track with our nutrition during this time without doing a complete 180, without driving ourselves crazy or feel like we're depriving ourselves to an extreme extent?
Mm-hmm. Well, the main thing I think as we're thinking about this ahead of the holidays is to do what we can now to make mental preparations, physical preparations for setting ourselves up for success, basically. Some things that we can do, some of these you've heard a million times before, like bringing something healthy, you know, a relish tray or whatever to a party that you're going to. And I will say, yes, please do that, because I can't tell you how many people tell me they wish that there was something healthy there to eat, yet nobody really wants to be the one to bring it.
Right. Here's some broccoli
brought. Yeah, right. So that's kind of letting you in on a little secret. Really, I think a lot of people want to have those options there. I'm not saying they want only that, but you will not be looked down upon for bringing something a little healthier than some of the other things. Someone else can bring the little fried egg rolls and the pigs in a blanket.
Well, and there's a general rule of, you know, eating 80% of your food consumption is healthier and 20% are your, you know, your sweet treats or
right.
or something that falls outside of the healthy category in daily life. Should this formula change during the holidays, or do we just think we let it change in our minds, or should we try and stick to that?
And that's a perfect lead into my next tip, which is create some balance. And when I talk about a balanced plate, I'm not talking necessarily about what you might be thinking, which is balancing carbs, fats, and proteins, or balancing your meat and your starch and your vegetable and all of that. A lot of us already kind of grasp that on an intellectual level, but I'm talking about the more human side of that that keeps us from feeling deprived, which would be balancing your plate with a little bit of pleasure and a little bit of nourishing, filling food that's going to help your hunger. So that would kind of be my response to that percentage thing of, you know, how much healthy food, how much whatever, is kind of an individual thing. And there's no reason why it should be any different thought process, although the percentages, if you actually calculated it, may be different at the holidays. Make
right.
sense?
Yes, absolutely. You mentioned that there are ways we can think of things ahead of time, like before we come upon mm-hmm. Christmas and other holidays that people celebrate this time of year. So what are some tips to think of right now ahead of time that we can apply to in the moment when we're feeling particularly stressed or there's other events coming up?
Well, for one thing, I think having a plan, some kind of a plan, beats every time having no plan. It can be anything, and it's what you choose, and it should be realistic. So it might just be, I'm going to listen to my hunger, and I'm going to enjoy what I eat and choose what I want, but when my body says I've had enough to eat, I'm going to stop. So that's a very simple plan. You could make any kind of plan. We talked about bringing something healthy. That's another thing. Not going hungry to a party is something we've all heard, which Yes.
Or shopping.
Or shopping, for sure. Which is really, I would say, on a very, very basic level, essential to having any kind of control over your eating. And this applies all year round. Please, please don't let yourself get over hungry. It is the best way to take every little bit of willpower you may have had and just throwing it away. Another one that I think is interesting, I would recommend resisting that desire to put a halo over your head. So in other words, by that I mean there's something called a halo effect. And if you're too good, if you try too hard and you go to a party, say, and you have a couple little vegetables and maybe a glass of sparkling water with a wedge of lime and, you know, maybe a small piece of lean meat and you leave the party, I'm pretty sure the next day, the next week maybe, it's not going to be pretty.
Right.
So try to just be human. That's okay. You know, let it be okay that you're not perfect. I talked about balancing pleasure and your nutritional kind of hunger needs. And those are five tips right there that I think will help ahead of time.
Definitely. And all these kind of tie into the component of willpower. So with your experience, how does willpower work? I know, you know, for example, if I see something, there's a trigger for me, and uh-huh. then you eat it. And then there's that sense of pleasure and that learned uh-huh. behavior. And it's really hard to, as you mentioned, get out of a pattern.
Right.
Whether it's a healthy pattern you've established or
right.
a bad pattern. So, yeah, to start, like, what are the basics of willpower? What is the science behind our internal struggles, whether to have that third glass of wine or whatever
right.
we're talking
right.
about?
And there are a lot of those challenges this time of year. So it's a good time to look at this. I look at two different ways that our brain works, and it has something to do with our primitive side of the brain and then a more evolved part of our brain that developed later for this reasoning ability that we have to choose. And our more primitive brain is that trigger response habit kind of thing. And we have those habit tracks, like I mentioned, where they just sort of play out the way they've been laid down. They had a reason at one point, and maybe they still have a reason, maybe not. But if you're not in a present state of mind, that is going to play out without any choice. The willpower side is activated when we can be more deliberate and stop and check in with ourselves and just become more present. And the important part of this, too, is without judgment. Because the minute you become judgmental, you may think you're present, but that judgment takes you into an emotional state, which then all of a sudden your brain is not as effective at reasoning and you will default to that habit again. So that's kind of the basic way that willpower works, the way to activate it obviously being more present.
Now, with this time of year, I always associate certain foods or dishes that are only made at this one time.
We all
so,
have them, yes.
Yeah, so they're that much more enchanting, you mm-hmm. know. So how do you recommend we, in a way, disenchant food during a time that's supposed to be so special? You know, you mentioned being kinder to yourself, but what tips do you have to lessen the pull of unhealthy eating or overeating during this time of year?
That is an excellent question. The main thing, I think, is that mindfulness is necessary, first of all. But in order to really be, like you mentioned, disenchanted with a food, that comes from inside of you. That doesn't come from someone saying, oh, this food has X number of calories in it or something. That doesn't always work. So the idea that you would become internally disenchanted means you have to be paying attention when you're eating that food. When you do those things, again, even if you do something that disappoints you, if you can become present in that moment and experience that without judgment, you'll actually get some information that will naturally, possibly, disenchant you. And I guarantee that if you eat too much of it, it will be disenchanted.
Yeah, in one way or the other.
And otherwise, you may find, gee, some people eat something they have been looking forward to, and they eat it, and they taste it, and they think, my God, I don't really even enjoy this that much.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that mental component, too, of
right.
we feel obligated to have something.
Right. So it's just paying attention. And then all of a sudden it's not this big battle. It's not I can't have it. It's I can have it, but I'm not sure I choose to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm not sure I choose to have as much of it.
Right. Now, one thing I often think about or try and plan around is, okay, say if I have an event later tonight where I know I'm going out to dinner or something, I try to eat better throughout the day. You know, mm-hmm. are there tools people can have that they can apply at their work desk throughout the day? Because most times people are only taking off those maybe 2 or 3 days around the holiday directly. But we're still working every day. We're still in some sort of daily routine. Mm-hmm. What kind of tips can we do in our daily lives that are still relatively controlled?
I would say, first of all, don't put the halo over your head.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to, as many people do, save all those calories for later. Then you have a couple things working against you. Physical hunger, which can be very strong. And also that feeling of, I didn't have much today, so I deserve to have all of this that I've saved up for tonight. So I think just trying to keep it as normal as possible, listening to your needs, again, coming back to the internal signals that you'll get if you're listening. Honestly, always, always feed yourself when you're hungry. That goes holiday time or any time of year. That will set you up for having a good bit more willpower later on at your event.
What kind of advice would you give people who are just starting a newer fitness journey or nutritional journey where they are changing their eating habits? Pretty, you know, say, for example, someone started a new lifestyle plan at the beginning of this month, and now here comes the time that it's really under trial. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for them to stick to their new way of life, basically?
I would say looking at it as a new way of life, for one thing, because so many people do not look at it that way. They look at it as, oh, I got my big challenge right now that I'm going to really beat myself up here for a while and drop a bunch of weight or whatever they're trying to do, and then I can go back to whatever. Or they may not plan to go back to it, but it will happen. So looking at it more as a lifestyle thing and looking at, again, bringing the holidays down to size so that they aren't so overwhelming. This is a little bit of a challenging time of year, but let's not make it this big monster that it isn't. It's a few meals. It's a few parties. It doesn't have to be the default from, you know, Halloween through to New Year's Day.
Right.
And I see that a lot.
When we get stressed, we often turn to those bad vices, whether it's eating or having a drink at the end of the day. What are some better alternatives to reacting to stress, whether it's during the holiday time of year or even just year-round?
Anything really that brings you to the present moment, makes you mindful, gives you some pleasure, because we do look for pleasure from food too. So we're looking at things like music, art, a hot bath, you know, something that has some kind of sensory pleasure to it. Exercise is especially effective because it does bring you more present. Also, for a lot of people, it will put us into a frame of mind where we feel more healthy and we want to do more healthy things. And I would say a couple of things that are probably worth trying for people who have never done any meditation or any yoga. Those are two things that a lot of science is behind how that can help us actually train the brain to have more willpower. The brain just gets more familiar with becoming more present. So it's like anything else. You can look at willpower as kind of like a muscle that if you exercise it, you will have stronger willpower. So those kinds of practices, they just get your brain used to doing that.
On the note of muscles to exercise, winter is often a hard time for people to stay in those exercise habits. You know,
mm-hmm.
maybe they're used to doing activities outside for most of the year, and now we're stuck inside. It's much colder. It's harder mm-hmm. to motivate yourself. What do you recommend to keep that momentum going?
Right. And it's similar, I think, to the eating. That's hard to keep going. You know, the healthy eating habits you make, the exercise, those are habits you want to create. That, I think, goes to the point of just building new habits. And then it becomes easier because you just feel somehow off if you're used to working out and you don't go. Mm-hmm. So it comes to the whole practice thing, too. I've heard many, we've all heard different, you know, numbers of days that it takes to get a new habit. I don't think that's the important part. I think it probably depends upon the habit you're breaking and so on. But practice is the important part. So figuring out something that's realistic that you can continue to practice, and again, not looking at this time of year as something totally out of the ordinary, kind of this might be the first year a lot of people might just take that challenge and say, I'm going to treat this holiday more as like a regular time of year, and let's see if I can maybe work on changing some habits now. There's no reason why you have to have a terrible holiday. You can still have the pumpkin pie and work on changing some habits at the same time.
That's good to keep in mind. And also, it's probably a good outlook for people to have to keep this in mind now versus waiting for January 1st. Do
right.
you think having those New Year's resolutions probably puts a little too much pressure on it and almost not necessarily set us up for failure, but puts more stress on us?
Absolutely, I think it does. I think it also is a big, big fat halo over our heads for the whole holiday because we know on January 1st, we're going to be so good mm-hmm. that it's kind of like a future halo.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll do this now and then I'll make up for it later. So I think there's a lot of pressure. There's also a lot of, call it denial or whatever. It's like, we won't think about that now. We'll think about that January 1st. The problem with that is that by January 1st, depending on when your holidays start in your head, that can be some work to undo.
Definitely.
So I'm more in favor of just thinking of the holidays as just a perfectly fine time to just, like any other time, figure out what's realistic and how are you going to go about maybe doing a small amount of habit changing now if you think that's hard for you now, but not just, you know, having a plan and not just giving up.
Well, these are great tips to follow, and I have to admit, I feel better already.
So. All right.
Thanks, Kim, for coming in, and have a very happy holiday.
You too. Thank you so much.
Kim Flannery is nutrition director for the Wisconsin Athletic Club and an occasional Lake Effect contributor. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski as part of our Fit for You series.
We'll take one last break and then give a listen to one of our in-studio musical recordings from the past year. You are listening to Lake Effect at 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Christmas is next Monday, and as is our tradition, Lake Effect will feature an all-music edition of the show, featuring some of the most enjoyable songs recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. But there are more performances from 2017 than will fit in one show, so we're going to take a moment on today's show to listen to another song.
Sarah and Kenny are the pairing of a classical guitarist from Italy and a jazz guitarist from Brookfield. The result is a laid-back, distinctive collaboration that draws on both of their strengths and creates a sound that is all their own. Here they are with a song called Pictures of a New Life.
Pictures of a new life, feeling of a heart's bite. Gotta be free enough to write, enough to care. Senseless starving you can't reach. You're feeding monsters you can see. If only I had, I never wanna hear again. Enough for tears. Years of learning. Thank you. shape the past. Forgiveness carves a way to a mess. The leaves that are falling keep falling from my heart.
Sarah and Kenny, with their song Pictures of a New Life, taken from an interview with them in the spring. Our recording was engineered by John Strelecki. That is today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.